Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Welcome to Undriven on Joy 94.9, tonight with Kafan and Hugh. On tonight's programme, we chat with another Joy presenter who comes from a non-traditional Australian background. Anita and her family moved to Australia by ship in the 1950s, and except for her mother's stubbornness, nearly did not end up in Melbourne. We will hear about the family struggles in those early days and in a migrant hostel, family health issues, and later find her life partner when she was engaged to be married. We've got another very interesting discussion coming up tonight on Undriven, so stay with us for the next hour here on Joy 94.9.
Gay and lesbian radio for the world at joy.org.au.
Good evening, Kafam. How are you?
Good evening, Hugh. How are you going?
I'm very well.
Do you remember a few weeks ago when I asked you about the orgasm, that dead people can actually have orgasm? There's actually another theory that when women have an orgasm, they can actually suck up the sperm and fertilize their eggs.
I didn't really need to know that, but never mind.
there's a name to this theory, and it's universal.
While they're dead?
No. This is another part of the orgasm theory. Is that it's called, when they're having orgasm, it's called the upsuck theory.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. Let's get into our show tonight. I'm sure the listener really doesn't want to hear this. Welcome to Anita. Anita is a presenter with Joy, Women on Waves on a Sunday, 9 to 11. Wonderful show.
Thank you, Hugh.
Welcome to Undriven, Anita.
Yes, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's an absolute, I love the show, especially at 10:30 when you do your comedy slot.
All right, yes. it's a very popular segment.
I must admit, I've never listened to the show. But anyway, a bit of background of Anita.
I don't think you should admit that.
A bit of background, Anita. Where do you come from?
I was born in a town called Bolton Colliery, which is in the northeast of England. And we lived most of our time over there around Sunderland.
Mm, so you're basically a Geordie?
Basically, yes.
A Geordie? What's that?
Well, a Geordie is a person, I'm told, the official definition of a Geordie is someone that's born between the River Weir and the River Tyne in the northeast of England. Mm. But my mother has a different theory. My mother says that we're not Geordies.
So it sounds like being a Geordie is actually not something that's favourable.
Hugh can probably expand on that.
Well, I would think, because I worked for a company and their head office was in Sunderland, so I used to go to Sunderland in that area quite a lot. And I suppose really if you talk about Geordies, it's like the coal miners, you know, working class. Yeah, the working class. So if somebody's middle class to upper class, or if they consider themselves to be, they would never want to be called a Geordie.
So, but I've heard there's actually an accent there.
There's an incredible accent, yes. It's almost like speaking a different language.
Yeah. So if I were visiting Geordie today, would I be able to understand them?
You'd pick up the odd word. Like if I was to say, morning fam, where you gammon?
Where you gammon?
Yeah.
I'm always gammon.
That's quite good, actually, considering you've been away for quite a while. But it's a beautiful part of north of England, isn't it?
It is. It's spectacular, especially around the coast part there.
And the people are very friendly.
They are.
The people today at Geordie are still working class, or it's changed now?
It's probably changed now. Yeah. If you go by the official definition of a Geordie, then it includes all sorts of people.
I worked beside a lot of Geordies, as you call it, in Edinburgh, and they were great people. Yeah. Let's talk about a little bit about your life in England before you came to Australia. Tell us a little bit about what life was like there.
Life seemed pretty good. From the time that I can remember, we lived in pretty swish houses in South Shields and Sunderland, and we actually owned our own home in Sunderland, which was a three-storey terraced house.
Because in the north of England, a lot of the houses are terraced, aren't they? So they're all sort of rows of houses, aren't they?
Yeah.
Red brick as well. Is that right?
Ours wasn't. Ours was painted green.
Oh, okay. That's different. Because a lot of the houses are red brick, though, aren't they, in England?
Yeah.
But a bit of about your father. I have in front of me saying that your father was a hairdresser. That was in the 50s.
Yes, it was in the 50s. And he ended up actually managing a joint male, female hairdressing establishment in South Shields.
I hope you don't mind me saying this, but it is quite unusual in the 50s for a man to be a ladies hairdresser as well, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but he was certified. He got his certificates and everything.
Yeah, but he didn't have specific certificates in ladies hairdressing.
Right,
that
right.
was just a thing that the shop offered.
Okay.
So he sort of had to manage that.
So would you say that in the workplace where he worked, that he was the only male there working?
No. There was another barber there with him.
So
he actually took over the management of the shop.
Let me get this right. So being a hairdresser, it's okay to cut men's hair, but it's a bit different, unusual to cut ladies' hair.
It was.
It was
in those days,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But what you've got to remember was he was a barber first and then a ladies' hairdresser.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Was he pretty popular with the ladies in the hairdressing department?
Oh, I don't know. I was only 7 years old by the time we left England, so I didn't check his clientele.
What is this so funny? Why is everyone laughing?
Fam's got to know the ins and outs of everything. But life in England was pretty good?
It seemed pretty good from a kid growing up, and we always had music around, even in the days of the old wind-up gramophones.
Oh, okay, yeah. So Why did the whole family get up and come to Australia?
You have a Swiss house, three-story high.
Yes. Well, it's a long story, actually, because my father was stationed in Africa during the war, and he was billeted with an Australian-New Zealand force over there. And he got to know the people, and they were all saying how lovely it was.
Okay. So he got the idea... We're going to Australia.
Yeah.
But you told me your mother had different ideas, didn't she?
She didn't really want to come, no.
No?
No, so...
Where did she want to go?
Well, she originally thought, if we've got to go anywhere, I'd like to go to New Zealand.
Do you know why she wanted New Zealand?
I think that there was some relative connection there.
Oh, okay. So she thought it was a safe option, go to New Zealand, there's relatives there.
Yeah, and we can come back after 2 years.
Okay, right.
And was your mother and your father relationship, was it an equal sort of relationship? Did she have much say in the matter in those days, in the 50s?
Obviously not. He came home one day from Australia House and he said, we're booked to go to Australia on such and such a day in May.
So he just booked it, didn't tell your mother, and that was it?
Yeah, it was handed to her as a fait accompli.
She must have been livid.
I think she wasn't very happy, but she was looking forward to the sea trip.
In those days, correct me if I'm wrong, but you had assisted passage, didn't you?
Yes.
What's assisted passage?
I think it was the Australian government that asked for a payment of £10, and then you could bring your family to Australia.
I remember that, actually, because I was pretty young. And
so was I.
Yeah. And I remember there was friends of my oldest sister, actually, because they were working at that point, decided to come to Australia and they paid the £10. And they came by boat, didn't they?
Yes.
It was like a 6 weeks journey or something.
Ours was actually 5, but that was because we were lucky.
Okay. Why were you lucky?
Well, because we came through the Suez Canal in mid-May, I think, 1956.
Right.
And we were actually the last ship that got through before they closed the canal.
Really?
So that Suez Canal
cut time down
by a week?
Pretty much a week.
Actually, I remember you said something about when you were going through the canal, something happened.
Yeah, I was up on deck with my father and there were a load of Arabs at the side of the canal and they were sort of waving their arms and shouting at us and everything.
And they had their headdresses on. And
yeah, I mean, that just looked like normal Arabs.
That seems irrelevant.
and what happened was that he said, I wonder what's up there, Jill, sort of thing, you know. Because we didn't know anything about the big crisis that was happening.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I turned around and I said, do you think it's because we're throwing all that muck out the back of the ship as we go down the canal?
Well, really interesting. But we'll come back. This is Orange Riven on Joy 94.9.
Joy.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Orange Ribbon on Joy 94.9 with Kafam and Hugh, and our wonderful guest tonight is Anita. Anita, we were talking about the Suez Canal and the Arabs at the site and everything else. So, and you're also talking about stuff coming out the back of the boat.
Yes.
And my friend here.
Yes, what the muck? I don't know what muck you were talking about.
Well, the main thing I noticed was old potato peelings and obviously the waste that was being ejected out the back of the ship as we went down the canal.
I'm just out of curiosity, not that I expect you to know this, but how many ships pass through that from England? How often?
Very regularly until they closed the canal.
So the Arabs should know by now that waving the fist wouldn't have stopped all the mucks coming out from the behind the ship.
No, but we weren't aware of the political storm that was brewing as we were coming down the canal.
Let's move on.
Yes, let's move on.
Let's talk about when you arrived in Melbourne.
Yep.
Now, you told me a story, actually, about your mother.
Yes.
When the ship arrived in Melbourne, what happened?
Well, we'd all got ready to disembark because Mum had said if we're going to Australia, then we're going to Melbourne because one of her old cousins had relations over here, over in Melbourne. So that was okay. We thought we were coming to Melbourne. So we went to disembark and they said, no, you're going to Sydney. And my mother said, damned hell, I'm not going to Sydney. She said, if I can't get off here, I'm staying on the ship and we'll go back to England.
So she was quite strong-headed.
Oh, yeah, she was pretty ropeable at that stage.
And your dad stayed out of it?
He didn't care. I think he would have preferred to be in Melbourne, yeah.
So when you first came to Melbourne, in those days you went to, was it camps or...?
Hostels.
Mm. So what was it like to go to a hostel?
Pretty awful, really. I mean, they had a school on site,
right,
which was the majority were foreigners, so that there would be a mixture of English, Scottish, Italians.
So all the people who just arrived in Australia went to... Whereabout was it in Melbourne?
In Nunawading.
Oh, okay.
So how big were these hostels? I mean, how many people come through...
They used to have these old Nissan sheds. I'm not sure whether you would know what I'm talking about.
No,
but they were a sort of a tin roof, and each shed was divided into three, and a family would go in each one of them.
So like the old army barracks type sheds.
Oh,
I remember them being in the UK, yeah.
So... you must have missed your three-story house back in England at the time.
We did, and Mum was looking forward to the 2 years being up because my dad had taken sick again, and he couldn't work. Plus, they had this issue with his qualifications that they said that, no, they wouldn't accept his qualifications after all, and he would have to sit the state board's exam.
Goodness, in those days, they actually have certification for hairdressing as well.
Yeah.
So what actually happened? How did you live? If your father was sick?
My mother went out to work. She got a job as a factory worker in a local factory.
Okay. And how did your father take all this? Because it must have been quite degrading for him.
Mm.
It was, but then Dad was sort of from the era that expected the wife to look after the family anyway, so it probably wasn't as hard as it could have been. It got worse after we left the hostel, actually. And
How did it get worse?
Well, Dad got even worse because they were treating him for ulcers. They had been treating him for ulcers virtually ever since he came back from the war.
Right.
And it got to the point where he had to be rushed into hospital, and they rang Mum one day to say, please come in, we need your authority, we don't know what's causing the problem, but he'd been sort of regurgitating everything that they were trying to pump into him, and they wanted to operate, do an exploratory surgery, and they needed her permission. So she raced into the hospital and left us at the house. That night we had a fire and we were burnt out.
Oh, my goodness.
All things seem to have gone wrong at once.
Yeah.
And then you lost all your possessions,
yeah,
obviously.
Did your mother at this point think we should go back to England?
Yeah.
I think she wanted to. I think she was feeling quite strained by the whole situation. Mm. And of course, the upshot of the being burnt out was Dad was still in hospital recovering after the surgery, which they discovered that the problem was adhesions from a... He'd had a ruptured appendix during the war.
Okay. Oh, so it's the appendix all along.
Yeah. And it was actually the adhesions from that surgery that were causing the problem, so they were able to clear them up. And
how long was it before life got back into track with you in the family?
It was probably a fair while, because what happened was immediately we were split up and we all were sort of located in different houses. And
right.
The family was very hard. It was hard to think of yourself as a family, really. Mm.
It must have been quite, it must have been terrible, because you had a happy life in England, you were all together, your own house, and you come here and everything just fell apart. Mm. I mean, your father was sick, your mother's working hard, and the whole family split up.
Yep.
So how long was it before you actually all got on track and all got back together again?
It was probably about 6 months after that, which was getting close to 3 years that we'd been in Australia, and... of course, the 2 years that was initially up, we couldn't afford
to go back
because we didn't have the money.
Mm, so you were stuck.
So we were virtually stuck here, yeah.
So in those days with expenses, and you had to go to school.
Yes.
And so your mother had to earn all the keeps to keep everyone fed and going to school as well.
Certainly keep us fed and clothed, but we also had, there was a state body, I can't remember the name of them, but they provided support, immediate support, so they paid for schooling and, you know, furniture and stuff for the house when they eventually found us a house to move into.
Excellent. This is On Driven with Kafam and Hugh on Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
This is the Orange Ribbon with Hugh and Kafam, and we're talking to Anita, originally from England in the 1950s. And Anita earlier was telling us about her life when she first arrived in Melbourne. So, Anita, you know, growing up at the time when you had the house burned down and the family separated, how was the family separated? Did you live in different people's houses?
That's correct, yes.
So you had to rely on the kindness of strangers or neighbours?
Yes. Yes, mainly neighbours. The person that actually owned the orchard that we were living on when the house burnt down took me in. My brother went, there was a new estate built the other side of Highbury Road, and a couple from across there took my brother, and Mum and my sister, because she was still very young at that stage, they went to a friend that actually we'd met on the boat coming out here.
Okay. So how did you eventually all get back together? What happened in your life?
What changed?
Well, I mean, initially the finding of the house was important. They found us a state home in Dufton, which was a new suburb which was being built at that stage.
Right.
And that sort of set us on the road, and they helped us furnish it and get Mum a job and all of those sorts of things. Dad decided that he wasn't going to pursue the hairdressing track and got a job as a clerk in International Harvester, which was a big factory in Dandenong at that stage.
Right.
And I'm just curious, prior to coming to Australia, did your mother work in England?
No.
And then she started working in Australia. Did she enjoy working, being, you know, a bread earner at the time?
I think there were elements of she liked getting out and being with other people because it had been a fairly cloistered life with just family and local friends. previously in England, yeah.
How did you find school in Australia compared with England?
Well, that's another horrible story, actually. When we arrived, firstly, they put us back a year, virtually, and said, no, you've got to go into grade two or something. And when I got in there, you know, I was teaching the teacher. It was so ridiculous that I used to get really flustered and annoyed that I was wasting my time in school.
Did you get the feeling a little bit that, you know, you weren't really welcome here?
I did, but that wasn't so much on the hostel as when we moved to Burwood. We went to a state school there, and
right.
It was a bit like the Poms were so unusual in those days. God knows why, but they were so unusual that if you had one, you picked on them.
Oh, okay.
But when we moved to Doveton, it wasn't quite so bad because everybody was a migrant.
Yeah, yeah.
Of some description, you know, and we had them from, I think, 27 countries or something going to our school there.
If it's any consolation, when I arrived in this country, And
what year was that in?
18 and a half years ago. I gave the immigration guy my passport with my visa and everything in it. And he goes, do you have a job? And I says, no. He went, typical, and stamped it and threw it back at me. So, I mean, so your treatment and my treatment was fairly similar, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
You're made to feel, oh, you shouldn't be here.
Yeah, yeah. You got to feel like you, especially after the fire, you know, you feel like you're even more of a burden in the country.
Yeah.
You know, why don't you bloody go home or something, you know?
I'm just curious, because you said, you know, the POM picked up on other POMs. Is it what you said? The Poms
no,
are a bit
no.
strange.
No, the Australians picked on the Poms.
Oh, so the Australians picked on the Poms.
Yeah.
But the
so it goes back. I mean, you think we pick on Indians or Asians now. I mean, good God, in 1956 when I came out here, the Poms were with the cheek bashing boy.
But nowadays it's not so bad. You know, I think we've evolved a little bit more.
And we did have the advantage of speaking the same language.
Yes,
pretty
yes.
much.
Except for the accent.
Yeah, theirs as well as ours, I think.
I'm just curious, has the Aussie accent changed much over the years as when you first arrived as to now?
I think it has, actually.
Is it a bit more ochre now, or was it more ochre then?
I think it was much more ochre then than it is now. Now you can carry on an ordinary conversation with somebody. And I tell you what, when I travel back overseas, I can pick Australian or New Zealand accent.
Yes, you can you?
But when you're here, it's just...
And you know the funny thing, when you go back across to the UK, your own accent actually stands
reverts.
Out. Yeah, and you can pick up... A Scottish accent to me sounds really strong when I go across there.
Oh.
So you realise how you sound to other people.
How you have changed over the years as well.
Yeah,
but it only takes you a week back in Scotland and you're talking like they are.
You're back into the slang.
And you will get your Geordie accent back really quickly as well.
Yeah, pretty much.
This is Orange Ribbon with Kafam and Hugh, and our guest tonight is the wonderful Anita.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
This is Joy 94.9, Orange Ribbon with Kafam and Hugh, and our wonderful guest, Anita.
And Orange Ribbon is a Joy 94.9 multicultural program.
And Anita just gave me the thumbs up because I said Orange Ribbon correctly.
Anita, while she was off-air, mentioned that Hugh doesn't pronounce his orange properly.
Well, how do I say it?
It sounded like on driven.
Thank you. You're not coming back on the show. That's it.
Hugh.
Now, Anita, I know, moving forward a couple of years, talk about, you know, your relationship. In front of me, I've got Maureen. Who is this Maureen?
Well, Maureen is my life partner, really.
How did you guys meet?
How? Well, we worked together, and I thought, gee, she looks interesting. I must get to know her.
How old were you when this happened?
I was probably 20.
Right.
And what was interesting about her look that caught your eyes?
She looked different, and she sort of came into the office and she sat down on a stool and she started just nattering away to people. I thought, she seems nice.
She seems smoky.
Yeah. Anyway, so I started talking to her and the 40th anniversary, actually, of the moonwalk was a cathartic memory for me because that's when she said to me, she really spoke to me for the first time, and she said, would you like to come up and watch it? We're going to have it on the TV up in the room upstairs. Would you like to come up and watch it? And I had to say no because they'd organised to bring a special television into our office as well so that we could watch it together downstairs. From there, we just got to be very friendly.
At this point, did you know that you were a lesbian?
Or attracted to her?
No, I was engaged.
You were engaged to be married. So, at what point did you think to yourself, oh, I don't really want to get
this
married?
that was when I found out that my feelings for Maureen were pretty deep and... he was a lovely guy. I've got nothing against him, but I really couldn't picture my life in the future with him.
How long did, after you first met Maureen, how long did it take before your feelings took over? And
well, what happened was the following year, a job came up in her place of work, and she said, why don't you apply for it? So I did, and I virtually became her assistant.
Okay.
And then her mother died, and she had to go away up to Lismore in New South Wales and organise everything up there. So she was away for about 2 weeks, and I thought, oh, my God.
You felt miserable.
Yeah, and we never heard from her, you know. And
at this point, were you just friends, huh?
Yeah, we're just friends.
And when you... find that you were surprised by your emotions?
Yes.
That they were kind of romantic?
Indications of that, yes.
Yeah. It's funny because you did a show with myself, Kafam, and myself, and Alan, and they called me the only gay in the village. Did you feel a little bit like that, the only lesbian in the village?
Well, yes, except that I wasn't in the village for very long. Once I found out what was going on, I moved down. I actually moved in with Maureen.
I'm just curious about the transition. I was curious about transition between from friendship to lovers.
Yes.
How did that? That must have been an awkward stage in between there.
Yes.
How did that come about? I'm curious.
It just came about because...
you have a chat over it or suddenly the hands touch accidentally?
Oh, well, no. She came up to join our family Christmas that year that her mother had died and she was home by herself at Christmas. And she came up and was part of our family Christmas. And we were repairing my car at that stage. So, I had her under the car helping me fiddle around with the car bits and everything. And I just thought, oh, she's such a wonderful person. Why can't she be here all the time? And
was it unusual for two girls to move in together, set up house? Did anyone question it?
No, not the moving in. When we decided a few years later to buy a house, it was still very much no.
Okay. This is On Driven on Joy 94.9 with Kafam and Hugh, and our guest tonight is the wonderful Anita. Now, Anita, we're talking about moving in together.
Mm-hmm. And with a lady friend. And what year was that? What era was that?
1971.
So did people find it strange that you guys were moving in together?
Not particularly, no. There were lots of women that lived together as flatmates or roommates or whatever.
Did you ever come out to your family?
Never officially, no. It's never been verbalised.
But was it understood at some stage that you guys were a couple?
I think so.
And how was it? Did their reaction change towards Maureen?
No, no, they were always very accepting of Maureen.
Yeah. You told me that your mother looked up to Maureen, and Maureen looked after her a little bit, didn't she?
Yeah, because Maureen retired when she was 51, because her job went to Canberra, she decided she wasn't going to go, so she virtually retired with a pension.
Unfortunately, Maureen passed away a few years ago, didn't she?
Yes.
And that was a really hard time for you.
Yeah, it kind of still is.
Still is, yeah.
And this is after 37 years of togetherness.
Yes.
But your involvement with Joy, did that help you get through this?
It did to some extent, because it gave me a focus of something that I enjoyed doing, and I met people through it that were so supportive and friendly.
Because at this time as well, your mother took sick, didn't she?
Yeah, well, what happened, as I was talking on the phone to you the other day, was that when Maureen eventually died, because she had been sick for like 5 months before she died, after the funeral, Mum had become very reliant on Maureen to take her to her medical appointments and things like that, for a number of reasons, which I won't go into, so it was a loss for her, but it had happened kind of five months before, when Maureen just couldn't do it anymore. And after the funeral, I think she went for 3 weeks, and then she had a heart attack.
It was just too much for her.
I think it was.
But let's move on to Joy a little bit, and your involvement with Joy. Now, you've got a wonderful show on a Sunday morning, Women on Waves.
How did it start?
Oh, it started before me. It started on day one of Joy in 1993 with two lasses that... Yeah, lasses.
That's a Geordie coming out.
It is. That used to present the program initially. Then I came on board to actually answer the phones and deal with the people that were ringing in for the show. And when they had to go up north the following year, they said, right, Nita, you've got to take over the show.
Just like that. And were you ready to take over the reign? Must have been so. It's quite scary.
I was freaked.
But nowadays you've got a huge following, haven't you?
Yeah, it's taken a while to build it up, but this Sunday morning slot seems to be comfortable with lots of
And you've got your comedy slot at 10:30.
Yes.
Which I listen to every week. I'm travelling into Joy, because I come in at 11, don't I, just as you're finishing.
Yeah.
And I listen to the comedy slot. It's really, really good.
And Hugh, you must invite me over one day and we'll have tea and listen to Anita's morning, 10:30 comedy slot.
Yes, it's good, it is good. Now, how did you get into the comedy slot? Because it's all Canadian and American, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because they're mainly lesbian performers, comedians, so there aren't that many that I've discovered that have got CDs in Australia that I can play or even interview.
But you've actually, I said earlier, you've got a following. You've actually got two chaps that have been in the studio with you, haven't you? They watched you. Well, they came when you had one
show. The 300th show.
Yeah, the 300th show. That was it. Yeah. So there's a lot of people who phone in and send messages every week. What style of music do you play?
It's hard to describe the style, because it ranges from classic to rock to folk to country. It's just whatever those kind of women. Are in the mode of recording, and there are so many of them overseas, and a growing number in Australia.
I mean, for us doing a show, just a pre-interview takes about an hour and a half. How long does it take for you to do your show?
To prepare.
To prepare for a show every Sunday.
It usually takes two to three hours to do an hour of the show. So I do 2 hours, so it's like sometimes up to 6 hours.
Goodness.
It's a lot of work, but
and
we appreciate it.
Yes.
We appreciate it, because it's
a
really good show. So tune in 9 to 11 on a Sunday for Women on Waves with Anita. And Anita, thank you very much for coming on Driven tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And very enlightening as well. Thank you.
So on Driven for another week, we'd like to thank Anita from Women on Waves for joining us in the studio tonight for a lovely chat. Coming up next on Joy's 9 to 4.9 is Simon and Paul with Global Sounds. Thanks for joining us on Driven tonight. We'll be back again at 7 p.m. next Wednesday with more insights into our GLBTIQ, that was a mouthful, multicultural community here in Australia and around the world. Also, thank you to Nick on reception for his help tonight, from Kafam and myself, Hugh. For now, bye-bye.
Good night.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.